This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Book Was Better, or When It Wasn't, adaptations, revamps and sequels.
Before we get into that, however, I feel like we should just have a little bit of a chat.
Yeah, obviously, Madeleine and I don't live in a little protective bubble somewhere, unaware of what's going on in the rest of the world. And obviously, there's a lot of scary stuff happening right now with the pandemic that's sweeping across the world. By and large, I think we've decided we're going to mostly keep Dissecting Dragons focused on speculative fiction and do what we normally do, writing, reading, etc., etc., opinions, which is what we do. This is going to keep being, I don't want to say a safe space, but somewhere to come for an hour to retreat away from it all.
Yeah.
Is the idea.
Yeah. Obviously, things may change by the time this episode comes out, but I don't think we can sort of go forward without acknowledging first what's going on and hopefully maybe helping you guys feel just a little bit better and maybe helping us feel a little bit better as well.
Yeah, definitely. So at the moment, we're just going to say what we personally are up to and what we're doing.
Yeah.
Obviously, I work in a library. The libraries are all shut now in the county I work in. I think there are still some isolated libraries in various of the counties that are open, but it's on a very limited basis.
Rogue libraries.
Rogue libraries that won't buckle under. Every county obviously operates its own county library service, strange enough. But I will still be going into work and doing tasks alone, isolated, away from other people.
In the dark.
Probably in the dark, yeah, let's be honest, probably in the dark, at least for the foreseeable. On the other hand, this, and I'm not trying to profit by somebody else's like misery or the general doom or anything, but it is going to give me the opportunity to do even more writing than I was already doing as well. So I'm going to catch up on my arc, so I'll come back with lots of it. And also, hopefully, I will acquire a backlog of books ready to be published. So, you know, once you get to the end of your current stack of isolation or quarantine reading, I should have some more for you.
Yes. Well, obviously, I work at a university. The universities have, well, at least have Winchester basically have stopped face-to-face teaching. So I'm working remotely. And it's been quite difficult, actually, because it happened very suddenly. Last week, or rather it was, very recently, we thought we had until Friday, and then Tuesday afternoon I was there, I was teaching my third years, and we got this email saying, that's it, after today, it's just over. And I had these third years who, this was the end, of their university period, this was the end of their university time, coming completely out of the blue. And it broke my heart because suddenly they were saying goodbye to each other, not really knowing if they'd see each other again. And there was barely anyone there. And I actually really teared up because I just thought, what an awful way to end what has hopefully been really good 3 years of your academic lives. And it was incredibly sad. And quite shocking in a lot of ways, because obviously we still do everything virtually, there's still workshopping, but it's not the same. So it was actually incredibly sad. It was very, very sad. and for me, you know, it's the end of my master's as well. I thought I had a few more weeks to sort of do my master's, but no, it's just over. And it's okay for me because I go back next year. I keep teaching. I'm still going to see these other pupils. I'm going to still see the staff. But for those third years, it was really, really sad. So I stuck around in Winchester for a couple of days and then I just thought, I can't actually stay here. I just feel too miserable. So we started our self-isolation back in Sussex, where I'm hauled up now, avoiding people and having to get up at 5:30 in the morning to try and get toilet paper.
Yeah, it's you know, I've always been a fan of like dystopian fiction, and I wouldn't say we're in a dystopia or a post-apocalypse type state right yet, but it's when you go to Sainsbury's and all you want to do is buy your weekly amount of kale and onions, and it looks like the zombie apocalypse has happened without the zombies.
Yeah, it's seriously, it's insane. Mad. And the other thing was, I thought, right, I'm going to get up, I'm going to get to the shop at 6 o'clock in the morning. It was so full of people. It was so busy. Yeah, it was ridiculous.
It's absolutely mad.
It is. And it's also created such incredibly sad situations, because of course the people who are the most vulnerable are the people who are living week to week in terms of their allowance, in terms of how much money they have coming in terms of their work. And they can't afford to hoard up on stuff. They have to buy things every week, and they go into the shop and there's nothing for them. And particularly the elderly, particularly the most vulnerable people in our society are the ones who are being affected. And it just breaks my heart. It's just yeah. such a difficult time. And it's nice to see supermarkets trying to now create measures for these vulnerable people so that they have the time and the space to actually be able to get what they need. But also, it also really surprises me every time I have to go out to get some food, how many people are just out and about. Like, go home.
Yeah, what you do. I mean, it's absolutely fine if you need to go for a walk or something. And it's, you know, it's really important at this time to keep your mental health as, you know, topped up as you possibly can. But mm-hmm. you should be physically distancing yourself from other people. If you've got a dog, yeah, your dog needs to yeah. be walked. And you should absolutely get out in the fresh air and walk if you can, to, as long as you're not sick or symptomatic.
Yeah. I mean, even just stepping into the garden, it's very, very important for you. So yeah, I don't have anything out with people who are problem with people who are out walking about, but it's just these social gatherings where, until recently, obviously the pubs and stuff were open and people just going in, and I was like, stop it.
Yeah, I have to say, I've met people from every single different generation through the library, because right up until Saturday, I was still working directly with members of the public. And I came across lots of people of the older generation who were saying, well, you can't just stop everything. And lots of people from the younger generation saying, oh, well, I'm not likely to get it anyway, or it won't affect me, so why should I stop doing what I want to do, etc., etc. And I'm like,
yeah.
I know a lot of it is people who are genuinely deep down quite frightened, and their way of coping with that is to try and impose what control they can, or just disregard everything and pretend it's not happening. Hopefully, gradually, everyone's getting over this culture lag, and we should get to a point where everybody's playing by the same set of rules fairly soon. But to get a tiny bit of rantiness out, the shopping thing is insane. And while I'm dismayed and amused for myself, not sure I can cope with seeing another frail octogenarian walking around with their basket and their shopping list shaking in one hand. 7 items on the shopping list and they can't get any of them because people who have just descended on the store and completely taken everything. Shelves are empty. And I really don't want to see another thing where the supermarket staff are trying to restock the shelves, and the minute they come out with the cages full of stuff, people are climbing all over the cages to get to them. And honestly, yeah. I might well bop someone round the head. Bop, that's a really nice way of saying what I would actually do. the next person I hear screaming abuse at a cashier because they can't take 10 bags of potatoes or what have you. Come on, it's enough. These are poor people trying to do their jobs. They're now overworked. They've been underpaid for years. And guess what? They're now holding the country together. So perhaps everybody could treat everyone else with a little bit of respect and just take what they need. You can always come back for more. There are, at the moment, no food shortages, but they cannot physically get things on the shelves because people are taking too much.
Yeah, and it's also... At the end of the day, there's going to be a huge amount of waste because a lot of people are stocking up on foods, which actually won't last nearly as long as they think it will. And the other thing is that, as you point out, the cashiers, people who are working in services, are not only holding the country together, they are putting themselves at risk. They're putting their families at risk because this is a service which is essential. And that's, I think this is the first time people really have to understand that supermarkets and the people who staff them, they are essential. They are essential. And they're putting so much at risk and they're doing so much, and I cannot abide seeing people throw abuse at them. When I was talking to the cashier, you know, at one point he said, "Did you find everything you needed today?" And my partner and I just threw back our heads and laughed. He said, "Well, some people have." And we just talked, he said, yeah, he said he'd sort of entered this other realm of existence because so many people had been shouting abuse at him that he was now at this point of just going, "I can be rude, and what are they going to do about it? Nothing. I can't be fired. They can't afford to fire me." Someone's just there like, "Sorry, there aren't this amount of stuff. I can't really do anything about it.
Try tomorrow."
Next.
Yeah, it's gone to the point where it's almost desensitizing. And I do feel, I'm glad that now from Monday they're imposing an 8 till 9 o'clock in the morning will only be open to vulnerable adults, the elderly and NHS staff who have to present an ID in order to shop there. It's sad that it's come to that, but it's important because there are nurses coming off 12-hour shifts who go and try and get shopping on the way home, very much as I used to do when I was in accident and emergency, having been on night shift. And they can't buy anything because it's not there. So that these are people who are literally working on the front line, looking after people who are sick, and they can't feed themselves. That's insane.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but let's also look at some of the positives, because obviously right now we're really focusing on some of the negatives of the whole coronavirus thing. I think one of the really big positives is that there's been a massive appreciation for the arts, because suddenly people are in solitude, they're at home, and you've seen so many creatives, so many educators, who are putting up so much content for free, who are just doing their absolute best to help other people without any gain. Authors in particular, a lot of authors are suffering at the moment because particularly authors whose book was being launched, you know, because suddenly they can't go to launches, they can't go to schools, they're losing huge amounts of money because of the coronavirus. And yet you see so many of them releasing content, so many of them pairing up with other small kind of like little businesses to try and make things work. And it's actually amazing to see this humanity and to see people actually in communities who are coming together. As much as we see the hoarders, I also have seen people doing genuinely kind and good things for one another and looking out. I mean, even just in the community that I'm in, we've got a group chat. And it's as simple as saying, if anyone is, you know, anyone can't leave the house, we'll do the shopping for you. We'll keep an eye out on each other. You know, if anyone needs help with kids and things like that. And it's just been
definitely
really amazing.
For every couple of people I see in the library who are like, "I'm refusing to change my lifestyle because I cannot cope with it," kind of thing. There are other people who have got together where there are you know, converted old buildings which are sort of flats now, and there are elderly people there who now can't go out to shop, and they've created a Facebook page, and for every group of sort of seven individuals, they've got someone who is responsible for making sure those individuals are supplied with what they need, the essentials and things, which is great. And I'm getting book packages together, so I know where they are on the system. I'll issue the books to them. I know what books they like. I'm getting them together, and you know, we're trying to keep them supplied with something to do and think about as well as eat. So yeah, you definitely. For the one reason I really really liked dystopian novels, and I'm sorry to keep using the word dystopian, I really am, because we're not there yet. hopefully we won't be, is the fact that when your backs are against the wall, you see the absolute best and worst of humanity, and we're definitely seeing some of that now. I have to say that mostly I'm seeing more of the best. It's just that the worst, when you see it, the abuse screamed at cashiers, etc., is so repugnant when you see it. It incites that immediate sense of anger. Yeah. But yeah, there is definitely a lot of people helping other people, and that's really good to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do have to remind myself that when I see these people who are acting hysterical and bad-tempered and stuff like that, it is just because they are scared. That doesn't excuse their behaviour in any shape or form, but it's a frightening time, and I can understand people being frightened. But the best cure for that kind of terror is to come together as a community, because that is how we have survived.
Yeah, be a community and not a tribe. Don't double down onto being just you and yours. Try and extend it, obviously from a distance. But yeah, try and be a community in our tribe. One last thought before we move on to the actual topic of today's discussion. Obviously, children are now home from schools and parents are looking for things for them to do. Obviously, I've never seen the children's shelves so bare in the library in my life. People were walking out with, you know, that the limit on a library card in Gloucestershire is 20 books per card, which, you know, sounds like a lot. And it is a lot. Most people never take more than about sort of 6 to 10. But they were coming in droves, and they were all taking out 20 books per card. So some families were going home with 120 books. I've never seen anything like it. But, you know, it's fine. They're only going to sit there for the next few months because nobody's going to be in to borrow them. And they were borrowing the micro bits so that they can learn coding and things at home, which is brilliant. And then you have these pages where mums who are clearly sort of, you know, trying to be proactive in the face of, you know, their children's educations being interrupted, coming up with ideas for educational things you can do at home with your child, etc. And that, again, on the surface is really good, but some of these mums are really invested in being the successful one, the one who is coping best. I never realised this was a thing until my sisters were kind of like, yeah, whenever you go to a mum's group, there will always be one or two mums who are in direct competition as to who can do everything the best. And she said, and they're the worst. And now they're coming out like apocalypse style. And apparently it's really, really annoying. So, okay, I can afford the position of being slightly amused because I don't have children. But I do feel really bad for anyone who's already feeling anxious and thinking, oh God, I'm just going to let my child play in the garden and get a bit muddy for a couple of weeks. It won't do them any harm. And we'll read books in the evening, being pressured by these mums saying, no, 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 they must learn their 12 times table this week, etc., etc.
Yeah, to be honest, I do think that this is a frightening enough time. It's okay if you don't do all of these classes, if you don't try and teach it. Let your kids just have a little bit of fun. Let them relax. This is a terrifying time for them. And I think the best thing you can do is read to them. And it's really cool that Audible right now have released a whole bunch of children's books for free that you can listen to. So if you yourself can't read to them, putting on some Audible, it's great. It's just really brilliant. So it's a tough time, basically. And it's a scary time. And I think as creatives, one of the best things we can do is actually to use that time to be creative and not to feel like we're taking advantage of anything like that. But because actually, during the worst periods of human history, the creative arts and stories and things like that have actually been some of the things which have guided and helped humanity through. And that is so evident at the moment with people who are quarantined who need the arts in order to keep going, in order to keep, you know, keep brave and keep entertained and just keep going. So I think it's actually just as important for us to keep creating as well.
Yeah, I think it's more definitely on board with that. And it doesn't have to be something that you then try and turn into a career or that you then sell. You can ignore the people who are saying, well, now you can finally finish your book, because maybe those conditions aren't right for you for that. But you can try something you haven't tried before. Perhaps you want to try doing a macrame basket weaving or you want to take up embroidery. I'm a horrible embroiderer, but I can just about do it. I would quite like to learn to knit. I might actually have time now, so maybe I'll try. You know, there's all these different things you can do, and it doesn't have to be stuff that you can then turn into something that you can sell. On the other hand, if you're someone who does write books and you've just been thinking, I need a little bit of extra time, if you feel you can cope and it's you're not anxious and it's actually making you feel better to write, go for it. And don't, as you say, as Madeline says, don't feel bad about the fact that you're using this time. So, yeah. This is where Madeline and I are on the entire subject at the moment. We're trying to stay upbeat. And obviously, Dissecting Dragons will be continuing.
Yes. So you can rely on us to
come in with an hour's worth of opinions on all sorts of random subjects, everything from the language of flowers to, to I don't know, what a history? the history of witchcraft, probably. Pretty much anything speculative-wise, or anything weird about the world that we find worthy of discussion.
And you always have the constant of knowing that no matter what the episode is, I will mention fairies.
The fact that you've managed to get the F word into a 20-minute discussion of what's going on in the world is testament to that.
You're welcome.
Okay, right. So, just to remind everyone what this episode is about, since we've talked about something else, we're looking at... Basically, this is an opinion piece. We're looking at occasions when we thought the book was better than the film, the film was better than the book, when we found the sequel to something or the reboot of something superior to the original. And we're just going to look at a few examples of each. Before we really get started, let's look at why a sequel might be better, or why a film might be better than the book, or vice versa. I've got a couple of sort of vague ideas about this, and I'm pretty sure I pitched them to Madeline and she'll expand on them as well. So, for me, this came up because lately I've seen several instances where I've actually preferred the reboot of something, or I've actually preferred the film version over the book, which I realise amongst the bookish community is kind of a travesty, but sometimes that's the way it is. And obviously I'll go into examples a bit later. And I think it's worth noting that sometimes you prefer the sequel in a book series to the original. Like, the original's kind of okay, or the original was like, oh, that was a really good idea, but I didn't like the execution. Or that character really annoyed me, I thought the characterisation was thin. Sometimes an author finds their voice and hits their stride on book three or book four, and you continue because you like the world and you like the ideas, but it's when you get to book three or four, you're kind of like, oh my god, this is amazing, kind of thing.
It's the thing of, you've got to get through the first book and then you'll really enjoy it, and everyone's like, I don't want to get through the first book.
Yeah, exactly. And you feel like you're kind of making, it's sort of like a loss leader, isn't it? Like, well, the first book, you kind of need the information it contains.
Yeah.
But actually, once you get to book three, it's kind of like, oh my god, this is so amazing. And then when you go back and reread the first couple of books, you're like, you've got a nostalgia lens to look at them through.
Yeah.
So they improve. And I also think sometimes a film makes a book more accessible. Sometimes books are presented or written in such a way that they're almost deliberately obstructive, or the author was very much more interested in style.
Yeah.
And they had good ideas and there's good substance there, but the style, for whatever reason, is obscuring the matter for the readers, and the film actually manages to present it in a better way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think another thing that really sort of plays into it is the fact that sometimes the book is older. So, when it's readapted or there is a sequel of some kind, not necessarily even from the same author, it's moulded more to the preferences of a modern audience. It's more politically correct. It's got more of the tropes that are currently popular. So we also have to recognise that, of course, a part of what might make things better is just the times that they were written in.
Yeah, absolutely. And a final thought before we do a little side quest, and that is, there are some books that, you know, okay, they've existed for a couple of hundred years, so there are so many adaptations, there are so many people, particularly now it's relatively easy to be an indie author, who just write their version of it, or they write a spin-off, or you know, I'll give you an example when we do our side quest in a minute, but there are so many, it's kind of really frustrating, and you feel just like, get some new material or take the themes and make your own, and then you'll find that one adaptation, that one reboot or spin-off that is so fantastic, you're kind of like, this is as good as the original, even though it's like seven steps removed
yes.
from it. So, you know, it's worth wading through a little bit of type stuff, because you can really love the original and so much that you will keep, you know, I love Beauty and the Beast, the fairy yeah. tale, and I will keep picking up Beauty and the Beast retellings, even though the majority of them are very mediocre. And then I'll find one that is absolutely amazing, and it kind of makes that entire search worthwhile. Yeah. It's like panning
yeah,
for gold.
Yeah, no, I'm a serious. If someone says Beauty and the Beast, I'm that's it, I'm sold. But yeah.
Okay, right. Let's do a little period drama side quest. I almost want to say, Madeline, please can we do an episode on period drama adaptations? Because I've definitely got enough we can talk about.
I'm
for an
so
hour.
With you on this. I could gush about this so much. In fact, when I saw that you'd suggested this in the episode, I'm like, we're going to have to be really careful, because otherwise we will talk way too much about this.
Okay, so we will keep this little side quest quite short, and we'll come back to it. We'll come back to it in another episode, yeah. I think, because there's a lot to talk about. But it's worth mentioning yeah. this in talking about adaptations. It's like there's a lot of them at the moment. We've just had the new Little Women
yeah.
adaptation. The new Emma adaptation mm-hmm. is out, which was something Madeline and I were discussing
yes.
the other day. To be fair, neither of us have seen it,
no.
but what we've seen doesn't fit with either our headcanon or the book description, and we are both a bit leery of it, I think is fair
yeah,
to say.
Yeah, the thing is, some people have really, really liked it, but I keep seeing kind of little gif sets of it, and it annoys me because it just doesn't look like Emma and Mr. Knightley. As you pointed out, Jules, they're all so emaciated. Well, why are they all so starved? They're so thin, all of them.
It is a bit sort of like, yeah, these are the upper class, the upper echelons of the gentry in Regency England, but apparently there's some sort of famine going on at that time period.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is not to be rude to the actors and actresses. I realise that they've gone for body types that are trendy
yeah.
at the moment. But in Georgian England, you know, you were considered... beauty came with a little bit of extra weight because it proved that you could afford to eat.
Yeah.
You know? So you could be slim but still sort of, you know, relatively well padded.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing is, for me, they just look too modern. They look too sort of pristine, really, for kind of the period that they're in. It's why I actually quite like the Emma adaptation with... Johnny Lee Miller in it, because I think the first Emma adaptation I ever watched was with Gwyneth Paltrow's Emma. Yeah, that's the one. And I kind of liked that one, actually. For me, they managed to sort of modernise certain aspects. Like, for instance, I think Knightley is actually nicer. He's a better person in that than he is in the original, because Knightley in the book is actually a bit of a dick, to be honest. He's not actually a nice person, whereas in that version he is actually quite a nice person. But yeah, that is what Emma looks like to me. She's young, and sort of has got that youthful, slightly rounded face, very beautiful, you know. Anyway, but we haven't seen it, so we're not being fair. It might be that the performance completely blows us out of the water.
And yeah, I completely agree. She's 21. She's obviously, well, you know, moneyed and very well educated and very headstrong. And I think part of the problem for me with a lot of these adaptations, and I'll own a tiny bit of prejudice here, when America adapts Jane Austen, generally they do it without understanding that there are a lot of underlying themes beyond the initial romance.
Yeah.
And it's not just America, but it's very noticeable in American adaptations of Victorian 19th century and Regency fiction.
Yeah.
That when it goes into the hands of American producers, quite often they will skim over the surface rather than really give you the themes.
Yeah.
Which is why generally, not always, but generally the BBC adaptations are better.
Yeah.
I remember having this argument on Twitter, not really an argument, but more sort of a thing about Pride and Prejudice, the 1995 BBC adaptation with Jennifer Ely and Colin Firth.
Yes. That BBC series is my sexuality.
Yeah, it is like that is the absolute pinnacle of Jane Austen adaptations, and other people saying, oh, but I really, really like the Keira Knightley version. It's like, well, great. I'm glad you like that one. The landscapes in it are absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, Jennifer, the music is great as well.
Yeah, Keira Knightley is you know, lovely to look at. But to be quite honest, that's not Pride and Prejudice. They haven't understood the characters. They haven't understood the story. The themes have been discarded. So it's great. If you like it, you enjoy it as a film, wonderful. I'm very happy for you. But it's not. That's not representative of the book, and it really doesn't compare to the 1995 BBC adaptation.
Yeah, and the thing is, it really is a very different kettle of fish. First of all, the BBC adaptation obviously has the advantage that it's not trying to put all of that story into a very short period of time, because it's several episodes. But... yeah, I think visually, in terms of the cinematography, the Keira Knightley Pride and Prejudice is wonderful. It's really beautiful, and it has some brilliant acting in it, and some wonderful music, and it's visually a stunning film, and it's an entertaining film. But I think you're right that in terms of the heart of Pride and Prejudice, the BBC adaptation, nothing compares to it.
Yeah. I won't say that I generally got basically called an old fogey, but that was kind of like the intonation. It wasn't particularly just me, in fairness. And it seems to be the idea that those of who prefer the 1995 version are the people who would like to be whisked off by Darcy. And it's like, that's just not true. As opposed to the people who like the Keira Knightley version being the people who would like to be Elizabeth Bennet. And it's like, no, that's actually really not accurate at all.
No.
It's like, everyone obviously is entitled to their opinion. This is my opinion. My opinion is that if you understand Pride and Prejudice, you will prefer the 1995 version. If you prefer a film that's fairly entertaining and set in the Regency period that doesn't ask you to work too much, you'll probably prefer the Keira Knightley version.
I think really it's also the idea that actually the Keira Knightley one is really centred around the romance.
Yes.
So if you want a romantic period drama, then that's, and again, visually stunning one, that's the one for you. It's got this sense of whimsy to it. It's got this real sense of drama, and there's a lot of sexual tension in that film.
Yeah.
But if you want... something which actually really looks at the historical setting and placing and the underlining themes, which are very present in the book itself, then nothing will compare to the BBC adaptation. And it's just a matter of preference. I don't think that we can necessarily say one is better than the other, but in my opinion, one is definitely better than the other.
Well, yeah, that's where I live on it as well. Obviously, if we are now going to do one an episode on period adaptations, then I will curtail this little bit.
Yes,
because I have other examples. But you know what? I will save them.
Yes.
I will just mention that I've just heard that the BBC are doing an adaptation of Enid Blyton's Malory Towers books.
Right.
And they're being pitched as Downton for kids, and I'm like. Part of me's like, oh my god, you're going to have to clean up the stories so much because they're fat phobic. There's bullying, as in bullying, and it's considered perfectly okay to bully somebody who doesn't fall in line. There's the whole idea of, you know, it's a girls' boarding school, but I don't think Blyton realised that she'd actually written in a lot of homoerotic tension without realising it was there.
Oh.
And then you add in the fact that they have the system of fagging. Fagging, this sounds awful. This has nothing to do with homosexuality, I would like to point out. This was an old British school term for boarding schools and private schools, and, you know, the big public schools like Eton, etc., whereby a newbie would be, you know, a new student would be summoned by one of the seniors to do jobs around their own little studies or common rooms or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd be asked to set the fires for them or to tidy up after them. And this was known as fagging. So you'd call for a fag. I know that sounds awful because fag later on came to mean homosexual. It also means cigarette, by the way, over here. So
yeah.
And in Ireland, most people will talk about having a fag. They're not actually talking about, you know, getting down with someone of the same gender. They're talking about having a cigarette.
Yeah. So, just as a side, there was a very serious thing here, which is that if in England you hear someone say, "Hey, can I bum a fag?" it means something very different. It means, can I have a cigarette?
Yeah, it's very much like, don't ask for a ride in Ireland, because that's not what you know, you're not asking for a lift to a place in their car. What you're asking for is kind of like, shall we get down and have sex? So it's like, you've got to bear in mind some of the cultural context here. But yeah, Mallory Towers is just like, I loved them as a kid. As an adult, I'm not blind to the flaws. And the one, you know, the main character, Daryl's kind of a bully.
Yeah.
And also, Ina Blyton, I'm in too much.
Yeah, there's some funny stuff there.
There's some not great messages. Like, I don't know. Anyway, I'm entertained by the idea enough that I'm willing to give it a go, which I know is really, really sad, but I'm like, God, this is going to be terrible, but I'm going to watch it anyway. I can't stop myself. This is the train crash that I've chosen to fix my eyes to.
Okay,
period dramas. And okay, let's start with the category the film was better than the book, in our opinion.
Okay,
all of these are in our opinion, and I'm not going to say in our opinion every single time. You're just going to have to take it as read.
No. Yeah. So actually, I thought this would actually be really a difficult one, but I actually do have several examples where I do think that the film or the TV series were better than the books. Yeah. The first one is actually a point of contention, which is, up until the last few series, I did actually start to feel like Game of Thrones, the TV series, was getting better than the books. My reasons for that was that there was a sense of pace in the series, which I was starting to lose with the books. And also the fact that actually at some point in the books, I couldn't follow what was going on anymore because there were so many characters popping up and so many subplots. And I just kind of wanted to follow the main group of characters, whom already there were quite a few of them. And instead we were just getting these very random side characters who, I mean, George R. R. Martin is great in basically really creating this very three-dimensional world, but I kind of just wanted to get on with the story.
Yeah.
And the TV series actually really fulfilled that in a lot of ways. I mean, it did have its flaws. And again, we're not going to talk about the last series, which, you know, obviously has... Yeah, we've done a whole episode on that. for a time, I actually, and this is me, I devoured the books. I really, really did enjoy the books when I was reading them, apart from the fifth one, which took me months. I really did enjoy them. And then I just lost it with them. And I was really enjoying the TV series instead.
See, I would generally agree with you. I mean, okay, as you said, we're not touching the last season, even though it had some good moments. And...
Mm.
I did like the books, but they didn't completely capture me in the sense of I enjoyed... I haven't read the last one at all. As in, I got to that point where I can mainline series, no problem. You give me a series and I'm like, okay, it's got 15 books. Great, let's get to it. And I will do it. But it does still have to pull me along. And I have to say, I got to the point where I was like, do we have to keep taking a detour every time one of the characters needs to visit a bathroom? Which is kind of how it felt. Bear in mind that I'm somebody who cut her teeth on Stephen King novels, where, and Stephen King does not take stuff out of his books unless he absolutely has to. You know, we go all over the place, particularly with his massive 1,000 page plus tomes. So that's not to say I didn't like the books. I did, and I can understand if you're massively invested in the world that you will think the books are better because there's more. And because you like the nuance. And there are things in the books that I prefer. I think the books have more nuance. But overall, as a piece of entertainment, I would say, yeah, the series is probably better.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I think a few people are going to get very angry at me for that one. And obviously, I think now I'm sort of going back towards, oh, okay, I'm going to see what happens with the books now. But yeah, so that's one of them.
Okay, I've got a couple of films that definitely think the films were better than the book, which, okay, the film being better than the book is a really unusual state of affairs for me.
So unusual.
Honestly, I'm not a massive fan of the Beautiful Creatures series. They came out in the wake of Twilight. They were clearly riding that wave. They're not, in my opinion, well written. They're not particularly original, and I think the characterization and plots are very, very thin. However, the film Beautiful Creatures, which has Jeremy Irons and Emma Thompson in, it's actually really entertaining. It's silly, it's cheesy, and it's kind of ridiculous, but it's still really entertaining. It's actually a pretty good film. Honestly, I think the books, The Beautiful Creatures Quartet, is probably going to age really, really quickly if it hasn't already. It's not even going to age as well as Twilight has.
Oh.
In my opinion. Because it was literally just churned out very quickly to ride that wave. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with that. You provided something that people wanted in a niche that they were, you know, desperate to read in at the time. There's nothing wrong with an immediate supply and demand. It's just, it wasn't what I was after.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The other one where I think the film was better, and I did quite like the first couple of books. I found them entertaining, but I actually thought the film version of Divergent was better than the books. And the film of Insurgent, the second book, god, there's too many ends. It's not Lord of the Rings even. Insurgent was again even better. I've never watched a third film. The third book of that trilogy is appalling. It's so bad. you can tell that it should have been a one book affair, and admittedly I only intended to write a standalone, so I'm kind of a bit guilty in myself. But the publishers clearly went, this has sold really well. We need more books in this series. And I just don't feel that the author then picked up and ran with what she had. I think she kind of went all over the shop with it. The films were better. But, I mean, when the third book came out, it was so bad that they split it into two films. And the first film bombed at the cinema, probably because of the book rather than the film. And the second film went straight to Netflix.
Oh.
And it's like, ah. Had a pretty good cast, and it was, you know, relatively entertaining, but yeah, it was at a disadvantage in terms of the material it started from.
Yeah. Okay, I've got another one. In fact, I think most of mine, I've got one which is a movie, but I've got a couple of TV series more. This is probably also going to be another point of contention. The Agatha Christie books versus the Poirot series. Sorry, so what I mean is basically Agatha Christie's Poirot.
Yeah.
The books compared to the Poirot TV series.
Okay.
Now, I have read quite a few of the Poirot books, and I do really love Agatha Christie. But I think for me, David Suchet's performance of Poirot actually just made him as a character so endearing. I loved the way that the characters were portrayed. I thought the series was incredibly well done. And actually added just a tiny bit more nuance to the characters than are present in the films, because I think Agatha Christie, in the same way that, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle was really concentrating on the mystery element, most of her characters are all quite similar. And that's still, you know, they're still using that formula in the TV series. But I must be said, I really just love the series over the books.
Yeah. I have to admit, I haven't actually ever read a Poirot book. I've read the Miss Marple. I prefer Miss Marple to Poirot anyway, but I loved the series with David Suchet, as you said. He's excellent. He just really brings that character to life.
Yeah, I really think they all do a fantastic job. Ha ha ha. Sorry, I was really channeling Poirot there. I think they do a fantastic job. I think it's, you know, the guy who plays Jap as well, and the guy who plays Hastings, and the woman who plays Miss Lemon. They all do a really, really good job. And the consistency of the series, the cinematography, the things that they dress him in, it's wonderful. It really, really is lovely. And I think it also makes a big difference in that Agatha Christie actually really didn't really like Poirot. She genuinely didn't like him at all. She was just a tiny bit racist. And she really didn't like the character, which I think shows in the way she sort of writes him.
Yeah.
Whereas in the TV series, there's actually a lot of love there. And he's not just this pompous know-it-all. That there's emotion there, there's depth, and it is just a brilliant performance. It's very well done, so I like it.
Yeah, he's really, really good.
Yeah.
Okay, let's look at a couple of... In fact, we won't need to go into this one too in-depth, but the book was better than the film or the series.
Yeah.
In my case, that means pretty much everything.
Yeah.
Because, admittedly... this is a case where I prefer to engage with words rather than images. That doesn't mean I don't enjoy the films. It just means, you know, if you give me the choice between the two, I'll pick the book.
Yeah.
I think the Harry Potter books were better than the films, even though the films are charming. I preferred the Twilight books to the films. That sort of, you know, liking them at all is probably going to get me hanged, drawn and quartered. Almost everything by Stephen King is better in book format. And the recent It... films, a lot of people liked them, but for me they kind of missed the entire point of the book, which was to examine the child-adult divide and what we lose when we grow up. And the fact that they divided the two timelines in order to do the two films as they did didn't work for me. And then they took power away from the one female character and the one black character, and that was kind of like that put the kibosh on it. And then they spunked the ending up against the wall. So that was kind of... those films didn't work for me, even though I liked little bits of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to agree with you. And Harry Potter was the big one where I actually really preferred the books. And I've just said this a million times, so I'm not going to repeat myself too much. But I think one of the reasons I actually preferred the books is that despite the... bad things that J.K. Rowling did within the books and the inconsistencies, her characters had significant depth. I liked Hermione in the books. I liked Ron in the books. In fact, I loved Ron in the books. He was one of my absolute favourite characters.
Yeah.
And you just don't get that in the TV series. They just changed Hermione and they completely butchered Ron's character. Nothing against Rupert Grint, who did a fantastic job portraying the character he was being, you know, cast as, but just entirely to do with the way that they wrote him. I think it was a real disservice, and I just also think that it was impossible to actually capture all of the depth that is in the books in a series of films. And if it was being made today, it would be a TV series. In fact, I honestly think it would work better as an animated series.
Yeah, quite possibly. Okay, so the rare occasions where the film and the book were equally good, sometimes in different ways.
Mm. Okay, I'm just going to go ahead and say Good Omens.
Yeah, actually, do you know, I didn't put that on my list, but that's a really good example.
I just think, because it is different, and I do think it makes a big difference that Neil Gaiman was actually part of the process. In fact, not just part of the process, like a huge, significant part of the process.
Yeah.
And that it, the character, the actors who were portraying the characters really, really got into the roles. I think that they cast them brilliantly. And that it worked much better as a TV series than as a film. It wouldn't have worked as a film. And I love the books. The TV series obviously added several components and elements, which were wonderful.
Yeah.
And they're different, but they're both charming.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I loved the series, despite the fact that there were one or two things that just didn't fit with my view of how they should be. But, you know, that's a headcanon thing as much as anything else. And it's a difficult book, really, to do justice to. In fact, Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett are really difficult to do justice to, even though they're both highly adaptable in terms of their work. So, yeah, they focused on slightly different things, the book and the TV series, but it really, really worked, both of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
My suggestion, well, I've got a couple, actually. One that is completely different, but, you know, the film managed to be true to the spirit, is Howl's Moving Castle, which we've talked about at length before.
Yeah, absolutely. They're so different.
They are so different. The book is a charming, sort of half pastiche, half tongue-in-cheek swat at, you know, the traditional fairy tale. Whereas the film is very much a bit of social commentary as well. And I think people don't realise that the book is actually social commentary. When you think about how Sophie is finally free to experience her own anger and to be annoyed by, you know, male attention and things when she's an old woman, in a way that she's not when she's a young girl.
Yeah.
And I think they kind of miss that a little bit in the film, but they give you something else instead. So they show you more of a sort of slightly distorted mirror reflection of the characters, but it is an absolutely gorgeous film, and I love the way that they've taken sort of, you know, the heart of it, no pun intended, and given us this amazing animated film. And I know Diana Wynne Jones was a big fan of the film, even though it was so different from her book.
Yeah. And I actually kind of appreciate that, because they could have tried to do something, and it's nice that it's an adaptation which stands up on its own. Really, it has its own vision, but it's really taken, as you say, the heart of the story, and played around with it, even though the characters are also quite different as well.
Yeah.
So that worked quite well. I've got another one.
Okay.
The Anne of Green Gable books and the Netflix series Anne with an E.
See, I didn't get much more than sort of two or three episodes in for the series, so I can't really comment on this one.
Okay. I found Anne with an E to be absolutely charming. I read Anne of Green Gables when I was quite young, and I really, really loved it, and I loved the character of Anne, and I thought that they could not have cast a better actress to play Anne in the series. They did a fantastic job of really capturing her character, which was brilliant. And the series is wonderful because it also deals with a lot of modern themes, and they've changed and diverted the story, whilst for me still really keeping the heart of the characters very much in place. So it's not necessarily a faithful adaptation in terms of the story, because they did change a fair bit, but it's a faithful adaptation in terms of the feel and the emotion and the characters. So I've really, really have enjoyed the series.
Cool. I found it interesting, but it didn't capture me enough at the time to keep going when there were other things to watch and read. And
That's fair enough.
My watching thing time is actually quite limited. So if I'm watching something, it's usually something that Alan's willing to watch as well.
Yeah.
Unless I'm making a special effort to set aside a time and watch something.
Yeah, sorry, it just reminds me of that time where we buddy watched, what was it, A Night for Christmas.
A Night Before Christmas. We should talk about that sometime.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk about the time we buddy watched something just for the historical inaccuracies.
That was fun. Anyway, that's a future episode as well. So many future episodes in this episode. Okay, two that I'm going against my Stephen King rule here for this mm-hmm. one. Doctor Sleep, the film, the recent film that came out with Ewan McGregor in, mm-hmm. is amazing. It's possibly the best Stephen King adaptation I've ever seen. It really captures the spirit of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they've changed a few things at the end and they've made a few things a bit obscure as well, which could have done with being clarified, I think they chose not to do it for a reason. Mm. It's a really, really good adaptation of the book. That was, you know, I can't say strongly enough how much I appreciated that one. And I've watched it twice now. I watched it at the cinema, watched it on Blu-ray, and I'd quite happily sit down and watch it again now. The other one is Stephen King, The Outsider, which is an HBO series. And it's The Outsider is a psychological thriller with supernatural elements. And they did such a good job of it up until the last episode when they kind of spunked the ending a tiny bit, which people seem to do with Stephen King. But the rest of it was amazing. It was really well cast. It was a slow, tension-building psychological thriller, and they really gave it space. And I think that's largely a big problem with Stephen King. He writes big books. You know, even his small books are big. His yeah. short stories tend to be around 12,000 words plus. So his short stories actually adapt better to film than a lot of his others do. Finally, people are giving his work space, so it actually really works when you watch it. That obviously wasn't the case with It. It would have been a much better series, in my opinion, and if they'd stuck to the actual plot. But, you know, you can't have everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, those are ones where I think the film and book were equally good. I mean, there are other examples as well. I kind of think maybe The Witcher and definitely The Expanse, the books and the series, were as good as each other.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, I think the books with The Witcher, probably because they were translated, and that makes things a little bit difficult.
Yeah.
There's some parts of the series which I actually prefer to the books. Honestly, I think the games do the best in really capturing Geralt's character.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is because there are the games, there are so many different versions of Geralt that you can have, obviously, depending which conversations, you know, which options in the talks, when you're doing the dialogue options, you choose. And Henry Cavill did do a fantastic job of portraying one type of Geralt. But, you know, in the books and in the game, Geralt can actually be a lot nicer than he is in the TV series.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right.
Moving on, the reboot was better than the original.
Yes. So I've actually got a couple of these, and they're actually both Sherlock Holmes.
Okay.
So the first one I want to actually mention is some of the old Sherlock Holmes TV series. And there's the one with Basil Rathbone, I think it is.
Yeah.
And then there's the Granada Sherlock Holmes, which came later. And it was obviously this reboot. And I think the Granada Sherlock Holmes was far superior. Basil Rathbone, it was brilliant, but the Granada for me actually really showed Watson for who he was, rather than just turning him to this, you know, this buffoon.
Yeah.
Watson was actually shown to be intelligent and helpful, and their friendship was really well, you know, depicted. And I just think that they did such a fantastic job with that one. So I actually do think that the reboots were very good. And I know that a lot of people are going to be like, what? Really? Seriously? But I actually really did enjoy the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes. Not least because it's not like they were trying to do the same thing. They were purposefully doing something very different.
That's another one where they captured the spirit of it and went somewhere slightly different. And I'm all for that, actually.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. It was quite interesting because you have this very childish version of Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
And it was quite sweet, so I actually really did enjoy it. But the other one I want to talk about is actually BBC Sherlock versus the American Elementary.
Right.
Now, when I first heard that they were doing Elementary, I was really pissed off because it was first series of BBC Sherlock, which, you know, I thought was fantastic. I really enjoyed the first series, especially the first episode. I really liked it, and I thought, oh God, why can't the Americans just get their own thing? And then I was really annoyed because I heard that they were casting a woman as Watson. I thought, this is just so that they can have a relationship between the two of them. And having then finished Sherlock, and the last few series of Sherlock feel like a kind of a nightmare for me. I genuinely sometimes can't remember what was actually in the episode and what was a fever dream. And Elementary, in comparison, is a lot slower. It's longer series. It's not as dramatic. You know, there are some low episodes and there are some very good episodes. But ultimately, actually, I watched it and went, my God, this is actually the Sherlock Holmes I know. Lucy Liu as Watson was fantastic. And they didn't just make her a woman so that they could have some weird romance between her and Sherlock. There is no romance between them. They're just friends. And actually, I think that having Lucy Liu as Watson really kind of actually created again that sense that Watson is kind of supposed to be the attractive one of the pair. Watson is meant to be the approachable one of the pair, and Watson is also useful and intelligent. And they really capture that in Elementary. And I think the other thing that I really liked about what they did with Elementary, in adverse to Sherlock, was that when Sherlock messes up, and he messes up in Elementary, he's called out on it. Watson calls him out on it. And he actually improves, and he apologises, and their relationship dynamic changes. Whereas there was very much in the BBC Sherlock, which was, we kind of let him get away with it because he's a genius. And it was also very unrealistic, the way that he was smart. Whereas Elementary, it feels a lot more realistic, it feels a lot more like the Sherlock that we know, highly intelligent, very specific knowledge, but also a human being. And ultimately, I just really enjoyed Elementary above Sherlock because of it.
Cool. I'd never ever got around to watching Elementary, so I can't comment. But yeah, I know what you mean about the BBC Sherlock.
Yeah.
I liked it, but there are bits of it where it's it kind of beggars belief a little bit, I guess. It sticks in the craw.
Yeah.
And also it's kind of like the writer kind of doesn't realise that he keeps putting homoerotic content in things. And he's like, no, this is an upstanding, red-blooded, straight man. And I'm like, are you sure about that? Are you sure that's what you've written?
Well, yeah, this is the interesting thing. There is more romance implied in BBC Sherlock between the two of them than there is in Elementary between Lucy Liu and Johnny Lee Miller. It was amazing. They managed to portray a man and a woman as just friends without any sexual tension. You have no idea how incredible that is.
Yeah, that is really refreshing. Okay, I've got a couple of the reboot was better, and this is going to get me exiled from the sci-fi community, so I really hope everyone appreciates my sacrifice.
Okay.
Battlestar Galactica, the reboot, was better than the original, and I grew up with the original.
Oh wow.
And it's not just a case of Battlestar Galactica the reboot was better because it allowed more scope for females to have roles, etc. It seemed to encapsulate the whole sort of we are living in a war crisis mindset where the human race might go extinct a lot better, whereas the original Battlestar Galactica was just, it was great, it was a lot of fun, but it was the sort of, there was more they could have done with it, I think, in hindsight. It was the sort of thing you would love as a kid, and you'd look at it now and go, actually, some of that's kind of thin, because the good guys aren't always good, the bad guys aren't always bad. People will act different in different situations, and they will certainly act differently in a time of war.
Yeah.
Because of the pressures put on them. So yeah, I much prefer the new BSG. I say new, it's not, it's like it's over 10 years old now, or slightly more. This is the one that's really going to be a bone of contention, is some of the reboots of Star Trek are better than the original series.
Yes!
I grew up, again, watching reruns of the original series. It was an incredibly important part of my childhood, my development towards sort of sci-fi and fantasy. But, and I remember when they first aired The Next Generation, I remembered when they were advertising it, feeling really defensive towards it and sort of really annoyed that they were bringing it back, because of course only the original series could be proper Star Trek. And I think it was halfway through the first episode of Next Generation when I was about 8 or 9 years old. I was like, no, this is really, really good.
It is. Yeah.
Like my loyalty to the original series didn't so much disappear, but just went to the side.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right with that one. And I do think it's also a matter of the times as well, once again. And also the technology that was available, the fact that times were moving forward and what was considered, you know, very socialist at the time was suddenly a little bit more acceptable, and you know, you could push different things. But yeah, I tend to agree with you. I really, really did enjoy Next Generation much more than original Star Trek. And in fact, I'm going to say something which is going to piss off even more people.
About to say Deep Space Nine was better than Next Generation.
No, I'm not actually. I think they both hold a very similar place in my heart. I'm going to say something which is really going to annoy a lot of people though, which is that I actually preferred the recent Star Trek movies over the original series.
It's a difficult one because I actually really enjoyed them. But
yeah.
I wouldn't say I found them better. I just found them good in a different way, which sounds like a complete cop-out, but they were like a completely different animal to me. So I didn't feel like defensive. Whereas a friend of mine who was very, very Star Trek invested in a different way to me, felt, I think, quite offended by the films.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a valid perspective as well. Not all the old Star Trek films are good either. It's like, the Voyage Home. People keep going on about the bloody whales, and it's like, it's not a great film. I'm sorry, I don't care what you say. Fight me. It's not a good film. The Wrath of Khan, the original, you know, which got remade, is basically Into Darkness, and they changed it a little bit.
Yeah.
I like Into Darkness, but the original Wrath of Khan is classic.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, it was the first Star Trek film was the one that really got me.
And that I would agree, that is better than the original Star Trek movie.
Yeah, and I actually really enjoyed the third Star Trek film. The Wrath of Khan was good. I still liked it.
So but in terms search of for Spock,
yeah, in terms of it's difficult. But yeah, in terms of the new movies, Into Darkness was okay. The first new movie was really good, I think, and I actually really enjoyed the third one as well. And I think the reason I enjoyed the third one was that Simon Pegg was actually really part of the process, so they brought in a little bit more of that humour. You had more of an even spread of all of the characters.
It was more of an ensemble piece, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Which is what Star Trek classically was.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I do actually think Deep Space Nine is better than Next Generation, by the way. Next Gen will always hold a place in my heart. There are parts of Voyager I prefer, and parts of Voyager that are like worse than any other kind of Star Trek, so well, except Discovery. I enjoyed Enterprise as well, which I know a lot of Trekkies didn't really like, and I'm loving Picard. So it's one of those things where this universe where you're rebooting and expanding it is really working for me.
Yeah.
One I will mention, I'm not a massive fan of the film no matter what, but I prefer the remake of Fright Night to the original. The original Fright Night is dreadful. It's such a bad film. And it's one of Alan's favourites. I don't know, I kind of really upset him the other day. I'm just like, I don't really like the film. Because he asked me as he's watching it, saying, isn't this great? And I'm like, well, for you, maybe. He's like, why don't you like it? I'm like, well, I find it really sexist, for one thing. And it is, but, you know, it was made in the 80s. And the 80s were really sexist. there's no other way of describing it. If you think of things like Saturday Night Fever, which admittedly is not an 80s film, but kind of got pushed about a bit in the 80s. If you watch it now, it's appalling. It's kind of like, oh my God, I can't believe that anyone ever thought this was acceptable. So yeah, same with Fright Night and a few others. The new Fright Night is much better. I think the thing is, the new Fright Night actually has characters, whereas the original Fright Night, it was kind of... Jerry Dandridge was definitely a character, and all the others were just like very thin archetypes that sort of surrounded his character. So yeah. That's my opinion on Fright Night. And again, I'm not an authority because it wasn't a formative film for me at all. I feel I've watched a lot of Fright Night recently, put it that way. Okay, how about the reboot sucked?
Sabrina.
Yeah, kind of in two minds about that. I grew up again with the, I say the original Sabrina, but it's not really, because the original Sabrina was dark, and then they made that very sort of wholesome Saturday morning kids show, which was really good, and I really enjoyed. And then this new Sabrina is all about sort of darkness and, a satanic portrayal of witchcraft, which I hate, by the way. And the aesthetic and the fact that it's just down the road from Riverdale. Parts of it I really like. So I don't know whether it's worse than the original or not, or I don't feel it's capitalised on the story. But then maybe the story itself for me is flawed because I'm just so bored of witchcraft and Wicca just being used as an excuse to explore the most basic form of Satanism. It's also worth saying at this point that Satanism as a religion in America is a very, very soft thing.
Yeah.
And this isn't me throwing, aspersions or anything over anyone or denigrating anyone's chosen religion. This is a case of the Satanism in America where it is very literally do as thou wilt. We're going to pervert Christianity. Or not pervert it, we're just going to flip Christianity so we hate this patriarchal religion. Mm. That is not at all what Satanism in the UK has been like. Satanism in the UK has been tied up with some really, really horrific stuff, and it is not considered a religion other than the fact that it's actually an offshoot of Christianity over here, but it perverts Christianity. So that is why it's so offensive to me personally to have witchcraft tangled up with it. It's a real issue.
Yeah, I think there's also... Obviously, there was the whole witch trials thing in America, and there was, the witch hunts and stuff like that. But there is a much longer history of it in England and in Ireland, and particularly in Scotland. In Scotland, it was terrible. And this very, very annoying... the fact that, there was witchcraft for an incredibly long time, and then the devil was applied to it... in a very specific way. It was the idea that these pagan beliefs were forcefully put into a Christian mold, which really annoys me, and that's how it's seen. And particularly the thing that annoys me is that when you still have things like, they talk about Samhain and Halloween, but then they still talk about it like it's to do with the devil. And
it was never anything to do with that.
Exactly.
It is incredibly offensive when you look at it like that. I can't think of any other religion where they would get away with that kind of shit on a programme. Genuinely can't. And it's kind of like, oh, well, it's a bit sexy if we make it all sort of one with the darkness. And it's like, do you know what you're saying? The reason the word witch was used and came to have such a bad connotation was due to the church trying to stamp out women and their... Okay, tiny history lesson. I'm sorry for going off piste. But during the medieval era, women were actually a huge force within the discovery and application of medicine.
Mm.
You didn't have to have a degree back then in order to act as a doctor. You just had to have studied at a university. A lot of the women did. Mm-hmm. And the women who couldn't study at universities or whatever often had a long tradition in their family of people passing on herbals and learning healing, and it was advanced. As in, okay, as an example of how advanced it was, a woman discovered plastic surgery in the 1400s. and applied it successfully. All of this was later lost, and it was lost partly because the church decided that they didn't like the idea of women having relatively effective methods of contraception and being able to make their own decisions about their bodies and how many children they were going to have. And they decided to brand it heresy, but it was quite difficult because there was nothing inherently heretical about women healing other people with herbs and things. So they had to tie it to something else. So they tied healing to witchcraft. And thus, a couple of centuries on, you got the Malleus Maleficarum and the oppression of women. And then you... God, here we go with the Victorians again. Then you got the Victorians who applied an extra thick layer of misogyny on top of the misogyny that was already there.
Yeah. Once again, we stress that this is obviously a very different type of Satanism that you get in the UK that you get in America. I think there are obviously probably some rather nasty people who refer to themselves as Satanists in America. You know, Satanism and the Witch's Bible and all that are valid and real religions, and we're not trying to make anyone who is part of those religions and who has those beliefs feel ostracized or anything like that. It is very to do with the fact that there are some incredibly nasty people in the UK who do some incredibly nasty things to animals and to people, children, under the guise of Satanism. And also the fact that witchcraft in general has just been completely co-opted by the idea of Satanism without actually realizing that there's several different levels to it, and that even the word witch itself is, it's very rooted in something which is historically quite disturbing. So
yeah, and I think that's the real problem I've got with the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, is the fact that it's supposed to be all about empowering women when the word witch was used to depower women.
Yeah.
And then in the show, you've got all these women who are supposedly powerful, all having to be subservient to a male high priest.
Yeah.
And then again, to a male god figure, if you like. And I find that quite problematic. Yeah, it's a highly entertaining show in a lot of ways, and the aesthetic is quite good, but other parts of it they haven't done very well at all.
Yeah. It's also kind of ironic because actually, if you look at real Satanism, it's about free will, and it's not about being subservient and stuff like that. In fact, that's the whole point, is that it's kind of to the contrary. Within Christianity, you're supposed to be subservient to God. The whole thing with the devil was that there's a sense, meant to be a sense of equality when you look at Satanism and the Witch's Bible and things like that. So it did kind of annoy me a little bit that they just sort of went, This is witchcraft. This is what witchcraft looks like. And yet they kind of used a template for something which actually, even within the Satanist circles, is not correct at all.
It's kind of like someone reporting a story and then saying, well, that's not exciting enough. Let's sensationalise it a bit.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's kind of gross. I've seen too many things like Salem, for example.
Yeah.
Another Netflix show where they've done the same thing again. And it's like, nobody in their right mind is going to want to bring an actual demonic entity onto Earth in order to oppress everyone, including themselves. It's kind of like, yeah, okay, we worship Cthulhu, for example, mm-hmm. because we know that he'll kill us last, but he's still going to drive us mad and kill us, so maybe we just won't. It's stupid. Anyway, not going down the Lovecraft route. So, yeah, reboots that sucked. I've made my opinions about Star Trek Discovery quite clear.
Yeah.
On the whole, that reboot sucks. The first series was okay.
Mm-hmm.
The second series, eek, ye gad, kind of thing. Honestly, I did not like the reboot film of Clash of the Titans.
No?
Despite the fact it had Mark Hamilton. No, well, I mean, I know that the effects in the 80s version is really shonky now, and you can see that they're little plasticine models. But I don't care. It was a better film. Weirdly, their focus on providing better effects rather than focusing on telling a different version of the story with the reboot meant that it was a weaker film in terms of plot and story. And for me, story is king. So
yeah, that's fair enough.
And I think that was the same problem with Conan the Barbarian. Conan the Barbarian is really, really sexist, by the way, but it's still a really good film.
Right, okay.
But, yes, the sequels are amazing.
And better than the originals. Okay, I'm going to say Six of Crows. I know I talk about this series a lot, but I read the original Grisha series, and once again, I've got to stress, I love Leia Bardugo's writing. I think it's brilliant, and I do think that she was actually quite restrained in the first series by having to kind of mould herself to do what other people wanted. And it's still a good series, but Six of Crows is just significantly better.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's... when she's finally allowed off the leash, she does much better work, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that the first... to be fair, I only read the first book of the first trilogy, but it was quite off the peg, I think.
Yeah.
It's the way I would describe it. As in, this is what we're looking for. We need you to write in this kind of vein. Whereas Six of Crows and its sequel, Crooked Kingdom, were much, much better books.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I would say, I know I've just talked about the film Doctor Sleep, but the book Doctor Sleep was better than The Shining. Significantly better than The Shining. I actually wasn't fussed about the book The Shining when I did read it. I think if I'd read it back when it was fairly, you know, if I read it back as a teenager, I might have thought it was fantastic. Mm. But I didn't. It was one of the Stephen King books that kind of got by me until I was in my mid-30s. And then when I read it, I was kind of like, what's the fuss about? Genuinely, what's the fuss about? Whereas I read Doctor Sleep and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. So I would also... these ones, I wouldn't say they're better than the original, but they took the spirit of the original so and wrote, created something really, really good. And that is Chosen and Slayer by Kirsten White.
Mm-hmm.
Which are books that it's a duology that follows on looking at the Watchers Council from Buffy the Vampire Slayer after, you know, the apocalypse has happened. And they're so good. It's such a good duology. you know, there's a lot of great callbacks to the series. She clearly loves the, you know, she loves the entire universe that she's writing in, and it really shows. Whereas Alan's reading the rebooted Buffy the Vampire Slayer graphic novels. And apparently they're very different.
Mm.
I'm not going to comment too much because I haven't read them yet. But it's things like Willow is established as gay and with a girlfriend from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And Willow's actually quite a cool character from the beginning rather than being a bit nerdy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm not sure because this is one of my don't touch fandoms and I don't actually want you to freak with it. Alan says it's okay because they're not trying to pass it off as the same thing. It's kind of, this is what would happen if Buffy happened now kind of thing.
Yeah.
So... I'm going to give them a go. I can't comment on whether they're better or not, or they're as good.
Yeah. I think another one where the sequels are better than the originals. Now, this one is actually a little bit more complicated because actually the originals aren't the originals, but Fairy Tales. Fairy Tales have obviously been readapted over and over again, and the whole nature of Fairy Tales being readapted for the modern day is that they're meant to fit the audience of the time. So maybe I'm being a little bit artistic with this one. Maybe I'm stretching the point just a tiny bit. But it's like I go back and reread the Grimm's Fairy Tales, and obviously those aren't the originals, but I go back and read the Grimm's Fairy Tales, or I read, you know, Perrault's, and all of those, and I reread those ones, and they're okay, they're good, like, I like them, I like the original Beauty and the Beast and stuff like that, but, you know, there have been some seriously better adaptations of it in the modern day, as well as some very bad ones, but I think the whole point of the fairy tale is that it is meant to change in order to fit the times.
I don't think you've ever made such a specific point with such a wide sweeping, like, base of subject matter in such a vague way and yet still managed to make so much sense. That was so bizarre. But yeah, I completely see your point. So kudos for that. Okay, I'm not going to say these are better than the original, but I did think they were amazing, and I know this is going to be a mixed bag for people, but I loved Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah.
And the follow-on film from that. Part of it is I loved being back in that world again, and just, you know, watching Newt and everything was great.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'd have been quite happy with 2 hours of all the different creatures, so that's clearly a me issue.
Yeah, no, to be honest, I would just like to watch just Newt on his adventures.
Yeah, the adventures of Newt's commander would have been fine with me. I didn't need a massive sort of Grindelwald versus Dumbledore showdown, although I was actually really enjoying it as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, sequels. Let's pretend these ones didn't happen.
I didn't even list any down here because there are just so many that I just kind of got to it and it was like there was a gridlock. My brain that just suddenly went, oh no.
Have you got a for instance?
All right, sequels that really shouldn't have happened. I'm not going to mention that one because I think that will fall out if I do, so I'm not going to mention it.
Oh, but I have to know now. You have to tell me.
To be honest, I think there's quite a few Star Wars sequels that really didn't need to happen. I know that the latest series has been, you know, the first of the latest films with Rey and stuff like that, it was good. I actually quite enjoyed it, and I'm not a big Star Trek fan, to be honest. Star Wars fan, to be honest. But I think that they've had a whole bunch of kind of series which really, and sequels and stuff like that within that world, which were just part of the cash cow. And
I wish they'd stopped changing the director in the most recent trilogy.
Yeah.
If they'd kept the person who directed The Last Jedi, that would have been a fantastic trilogy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't a fan of a lot of what they did with The Rise of Skywalker. I liked it, and I will like it, and I'll watch it again, and I know I'll watch it and love it because it's Star Wars, and again, it's one of those just give me more type fandoms. Yeah. But I'm aware from an analytical point of view that it wasn't great.
Yeah, and because
in a lot of ways,
and because it's not just that. I mean, they've got a whole bunch of other series, and to be fair, I haven't really watched them. But you know, they had the Solo movie, they had they've got the Mandalorian at the moment and stuff like that. And by all accounts, the Mandalorian looks like it's fun. I don't know, I haven't watched it. But I think the Solo movie kind of actually did drop a little bit, which is a shame because there were some really good actors in it, and I thought that, you know, there was some good opportunity there.
It was all right. I mean, there's going to be a Obi-Wan Kenobi series as well. Basically, Disney Plus is going to drown us in Star Wars spin-offs till the end of time now, so I hope everyone's up for that. We have made a decision that we're not going to support Disney Plus. We're not going to get it.
No.
So unless these things come out on DVD, we're not going to be watching them.
Yeah,
okay. Largely because we don't want Disney to own great big chunks of property and keep taking it away from everybody else getting a shot at putting it on their streaming service as well.
Yeah, there's a bit of a monopoly going on there. Yeah.
And Disney is very, very sharky. It's produced some wonderful stuff, but it's really sharky, and that's not something I...
Yeah, it's one of those things where you can really appreciate some of the content that they've created, and obviously, you know, that the visions of the individual artists and creators who are working under Disney, but you can be suspicious of the company itself, to be honest.
Okay, my example for this one, there are lots of ones where I think, oh, that shouldn't have happened, but I've kind of erased most of them from my head if they're films.
Yeah.
I love the fact that I can watch a film and be like forgetting it as I watch it. I can't do that with books.
Yeah.
This is more a case of I'm glad it happened, and I really enjoyed it, and I genuinely thought it was amazing, but I wish parts of it hadn't happened, and I realise that's quite a distinction. And that's The Cursed Child.
Yeah.
If they had done it so that it entirely followed on from the books rather than taking the bits I didn't like from the films to pad it out, I would have been all for it. I hated what they did with Ginny and I hated what they did with Ron.
Yeah. Yeah, they did the Weasleys a bit of a disservice, to be honest.
And it's like, it shouldn't have happened like that. I mean, I'm a bit sort of unsure with Harry having such a dramatic conflict with his son initially, but I can understand it. You could sell me on that, yeah, probably. But what they did with Ron and Ginny, Ginny didn't get a character at all. And it's like, can we just remember that she was actually kind of badass? She was a really talented witch. She went on to play for the Holyhead Harpies at Quidditch.
Yeah.
She did all this shit. She didn't just become a stay-at-home soccer mum. So that fucked me off a lot.
Yeah, no, that really pissed me off. I enjoyed The Cursed Child. I also think they did Cedric Diggory a bit of a disservice by saying that he would become a Death Eater, because really, seriously, I don't think he would have.
Really? From Hufflepuff?
Yeah, like...
And, you know, Golden Boy?
Yeah.
Really nice person, genuinely.
Genuinely a good person, just... yeah. So, yeah, I think they did a disservice there. I did like what they did with Malfoy, to be honest. That he got a bit of a redemption, that, you know, that he was still the person that he was, but he actually kind of had grown up a little bit. And I really did like Scorpio. I thought Scorpio was a fantastic character. So they did have some really good stuff, but I think you're right that actually they did do some stuff which irritated me, really. But
yeah.
Hey-ho.
Because you've just made me think about childhood enemies sort of meeting as adults and sort of managing to rub along together, even though they still don't really like each other. I'm just harking back to sequels that were really good, and that is Cobra Kai, which is a YouTube original series that follows... it's sort of set 35 years after Karate Kid, and... it really works. apart from the last season where everybody has been training in karate for like 6 weeks and suddenly they're having this really, really violent all-in fight in the school, which is utterly unbelievable because, I'm sorry, after 6 weeks of karate training twice a week as a white belt, if you can actually tie your belt and make a fist, I'm impressed. Okay? Most white belts can't manage that. There is no way they would have had that massive choreographed fight and actually managed to injure anyone except themselves.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But the rest of it, the whole dynamic between Daniel LaRusso and... his name's gone out of my head. The main character of Cobra Kai was just, it really worked. It worked really well. There was enough that they've got in common that they could be really good friends and they should be. And then every so often one of them will say something and it just sets the other one off again. And they're both dicks in their own way. That's the thing. I really hope the end game is kind of like, okay, we're gonna do karate together because we've realised there is benefits in both our styles.
Yeah.
And we're going to stop being so snobby. I would love to see that actually happen, because I have to say, as someone who spent 25 plus years doing martial arts, there is very much a my style's better than your style. And you know what I've learned from doing 12 different martial arts? That's not even 12 different karate styles. That's 12 actual different martial arts. Various levels, is the fact that everyone says their style's best. It's not true. What's best is, you know, having a good instructor who is willing to take whatever they can and teach you it, and you adapting what you've learned to suit you and yourself. So there is no one martial art that conquers all. If you study lots of different ones, you will get something that is something like being complete.
Yeah.
So seeing that reflected is really great. And I know a lot of it is kind of nostalgia for me as well. It's kind of like, oh, I remember those days when you used to believe your sensei because your sensei was kind of like a parent. And you know what? They're just human and they're talking bollocks. Yes. Any karate people listening to this, or, you know, you should listen to your sensei.
Yeah.
Unless they're telling you to do something stupid. Don't lose your ability to question.
Yeah.
God's sake.
And realistically, that I like to think that there aren't too many of those kinds of people who are kind of abusing power in that way. Or,
I've met too many of them not to know that there's a lot of them out there.
Yeah, I've been very lucky.
Yeah, so that one worked for me. And we have talked a lot about a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And I think we should wrap it up now.
I think we should, yeah.
So, yeah, if you've got an example of an adaptation that was better than the book.
Or worse.
Or worse. Or you liked the sequel better than the original, then let us know.
Yeah, do leave us a comment. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and I've got a slightly odd one for you this week.
Okay.
It's not speculative fiction. It is actually James May's Our Man in Japan. Now, there is certainly a little bit of cringe in that series as well, but I've actually really been enjoying it. As someone who's been to Japan quite a few times and as someone who has actually studied the Japanese language for quite a few years, I found it very, very interesting to watch this. And I think that he actually does the country a fair bit of justice and actually kind of really highlights some very interesting parts of the culture and country that you might not actually have heard about, and looks at some of the other things that are kind of less explored within it. So it's actually well worth watching. It's quite funny, and it does show off some interesting corners of Japan. So definitely worth checking out. It's on Amazon. I just think it's a bit of fun. It's actually quite nice to watch.
Okay, then. Anyway, so everybody, quarantine buddies, self-isolation buddies, stay in, stay safe.
Yeah.
Stay mentally healthy by, you know, taking a little bit of exercise in the garden if you've got one, or going for a little walk quietly by yourself.
Yeah. And
stay in touch with us.
Yes, we'd love to hear from you. And if there's anything you kind of want us to talk about, you know, if there's anything you think, oh God, you know what I could really do with a very long discussion about X, Y, Z, let us know. And yeah, just be careful, guys. Lots of love to you all. And we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah. Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.